This is the number one politics, society, and culture podcast that you'll ever hear. It's called the Toasty Podcast. Look, if anyone is going to start a media revolution, it might as well be us. Sky created the Toasty brand to influence people in a positive way in order to empower independent thinkers such as himself to stand up for what they believe in. And here at the Toasty Podcast, we call that staying toasty. So, where does that leave you? It's simple, really. When you support our work, you're supporting the good fight. We produce podcasts, create YouTube and TikTok content, and design apparel that isn't made in China for you. We want to engage culture, so let's get toasty. This vaccine is getting freaking abused by the higher powers. What's up, guys? Welcome to the Toasty Podcast. My name is Sky.
I'm Maddie B.
And today, we're going to give you guys a little bit of a special, a little bit of a deep dive, you know, soaking up the fun in the sun.
We haven't done a deep dive in so long.
I know, we haven't. And I like them. I like them, you know. Yeah. The thing is we get all, like, you know, into it. Commentary, just talking. And there's a lot of news happening right now, so I like to stay on top of that. Yeah. Eventually, we'll have multiple podcasts, so it'll be okay. We can do all these things at once, but in the future. And guys, this is the toastiest one yet. And if you have never heard us before, welcome to the Toasty Podcast, but also be sure and like, share, and subscribe. The main one being share. That is how we freaking grow, guys. It's the only way podcasts grow because podcasts don't have algorithms like, you know, YouTube and all these other freaking fancy stuff like TikTok or whatever.
We don't have big billboards in Times Square.
We don't do that, you know, and that'd be cool, honestly. I thought about it, you know, getting billboards would be sick, but money,
billboards,
bro,
are expensive.
Money, yeah, I know. Money,
like,
please.
Okay, so I used to work at a pizza place called Hungry Howie's in College Station. College Station's a town of about 150,000 people. 150,000 people. With Brian included, so it's like Brian College Station. And the pizza owner opened up a new store. It was right on the edge of Brian College Station, and he got this billboard. I can't remember how long he got it for. I want to say it was like 6 months or maybe a year. You know how much it cost?
$500 a month?
$30,000.
Brian, he bought it? Or he was renting it for the...
He got... Yeah.
In Brian College Station?
Yeah.
Holy crap, dude, because it's a college town.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
But why it was like it, in the middle of town. Like,
why is it more expensive to advertise to young adults? You know?
Because they're the ones... Well, the thing is... Yeah, okay,
that's not our audience.
It depends,
you know,
on young adults. Like, if you're talking young adults that are 30, you know, or so, that have a good job and are ready to go, they're willing to spend the money.
Yeah.
They don't have kids yet, but they've got the income.
In a college town?
Well, they got mommy and daddy's money in that town.
Okay, dude, that's crazy. $30,000 a month or a year or what?
I have no idea. I know he paid about 30 grand for it.
It may be a year.
He probably,
or maybe
probably
like
about
a contract.
It's probably about a year.
Like a lease contract. Yeah, maybe what it is.
He leased it probably.
Because like around here in DFW, you can find billboards everywhere, of course. And like some of them are $500 a month. Some of them are like contracts for 3 grand for 6 months or whatever. Like, it just depends.
When I heard that, I was like, that is astronomical for a freaking billboard. Anyway.
Holy crap, dude. That's what we're talking about, guys. It takes a lot of money to advertise things.
It does, yes.
And with that said, if you guys want to help out the show, go buy some merch on toastycreations.com. Yes. That is where we have all of our t-shirts, and I'm trying to make more every
day.
Stickers.
Put a sticker on your car, on your
mini
fridge.
Dude, get a freaking little toast sticker, bro. It's a little toast and jelly sticker, you know? But I don't know. I'm trying to design more for you guys. It just takes a long time, so whatever. I'll keep trying, man. Keep doing it. I want to come out with some more, like, freedom stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Like, America. Like, yeah, just like guns or whatever. I don't know, dude. We'll see. We'll see what happens.
Cool.
Anyway, we can get into it, you know what I'm saying? So, if you want to, let's try to give the listeners, because I've kind of forgotten myself, what actually happened. Like, the actual event of 9/11, you know, the official narrative is what we want.
So... I'm going to give my personal story first.
Okay.
I was in fourth grade. My teacher was Mrs. Miller. And like most Americans.
I forget you're older than me.
Yeah. Like most Americans at that time, you'll never, ever forget where you were, what you were doing, the whole timeline of events for that day. Even though I was only about 9 or 10 years old. Actually, I had just turned 10. Because my birthday is September 4th. And... it is one of those things where, like, the like if you were alive in November 22nd, 1963, you're going to never forget what you were doing that day, where you were when you heard that the president had been killed, assassinated. So I was in my classroom, you know, obviously early morning. The attacks happened at about early morning. I think it was probably around 9 o'clock in the morning is when the planes actually hit the towers. So we had been in school for probably half an hour or so at the time. It's still early morning. Central time is about 8 o'clock. And there's a lot of chatter going on. A lot of the kids are talking to each other. A lot of kids are getting called into the office and then getting checked out of school. A lot of parents were coming to pick up their kids. And I'm like, why are kids getting picked up from school? And one of my classmates, I think it was a guy named Blake Hyatt at the time, said to me, we've been bombed. We've been attacked. And I'll never forget hearing those words and thinking, who would be that dumb to attack this country with the strongest, you know, most aggressive military on the planet? Who would be that dumb? And I was like, okay. I mean, that was obviously nobody had a lot of information at that time. So we basically gather in the cafeteria before class starts to kind of like gather all the students, and then they go to their classrooms. And between being in the cafeteria and going to the classroom, a lot of kids are getting pulled out of school, and we kind of try to start a normal day. And my teacher, Mrs. Miller, who was probably in her mid-60s, if I had to guess, she gets called out of the class real quick, says, hey, I'll be right back. And that's when the principal tells the teacher what's going on. Remember, this is like very early days of internet. You know, it wasn't really... Everybody turned on the news on TV to see what was going on. They didn't just pop open their phones to get the news. And she comes back in the classroom, and in a very, like, solemn tone, she says, they told us not to tell you what was going on, and I can't do that. You need to know what happened. And she says, there's been an attack on our country in New York, and... she said something along the lines of, like, we just need to pray and be vigilant and don't be afraid. And then she went on to teach the class. And I went through the entire day of school, didn't get picked up. My parents went through their entire day of work. We were not interrupted in my family. And, when I got home around 3:30, 4 o'clock, all we could do was watch the news. And even though I was the youngest in my family, 10 years old, freshly 10, all we could do was watch the news over and over and over. And I remember thinking, like, what kind of cowards would do something like this? Who in their right minds would attack America? Why would they not like us? You know, I was so confused. And I remember, the honesty and bravery of my teacher for actually going against the school's policy at the time and telling our young classroom what had happened and being honest. So that's what I remember that day.
Wow. Yeah. My teacher actually showed us. She was like, here you go. We turned on the news in class.
we didn't have TVs in our
crazy,
classroom.
Man. So. I was in second grade. So
yeah,
I didn't know anything though.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't know. I was like, oh my gosh, that's crazy. That towers are being like destroyed, but I didn't know anything about New York. I didn't know anything about the World Trade Center. Mm-hmm. Right, I'm a second grader, dude.
I knew what the World Trade Center was. I knew New York, and the reason a lot of parents were pulling kids out of school is to show them what was going on and to be with their kids during that time. And another big reason is there's another World Trade Center in Dallas, and
right.
They thought they might be attacking all of our World Trade Centers.
You never know, right? They didn't know where they were going.
There was so much mass confusion.
I'm in like small town East Texas, so no one gave a crap. Okay, they gave a crap, but
So that's my recollection of 9/11. I'm sure everybody's got their own stories, but everybody had to be a little bit brave that day, for sure. Even a fourth grade teacher in Texas. So, first, I would really just like to go through a timeline of major events, and this is just from Wikipedia.
Well, hold on. Official narrative. We need that.
That's what this is.
Oh, okay, cool. Sweet.
This is a timeline of major events, day of.
Oh, day of. Nice.
Yes. So I'm going to go day of, and then I'm going to do some background.
Dude, that's good.
And then I'm probably going to... So this is...
Let's get freaking toasty, dude.
These bullet points are going to be major events. And I'm just pulling this from Wikipedia. They're just like very brief bullet points. And then I'm going to elaborate based off of my personal knowledge on what I can elaborate on. So this is day of 9/11, 2001, major events. 7:59 a.m., this is all East Coast time. American Airlines Flight 11, Boeing 767, carrying 81 passengers. Now, mind you, a Boeing 767 is a huge aircraft, and 81 passengers is a very light load for that aircraft. I mean, it's like a 300-passenger plane. So 81 passengers, 11 crew members, departs 14 minutes late from Logan International Airport in Boston, bound for LA, LAX, and five hijackers are on board. Flight 11. I believe that was the one that hit the North Tower, I believe. The North Tower struck first. At 8:14, so 15 minutes later, United Airlines Flight 175, a Boeing 767 again, carrying 56 passengers and nine crew members, departs 14 minutes late again. Same exact scenario, both 14 minutes late from Logan International Airport in Boston, bound for LA. Five hijackers are on board. So basically identical flights going from Boston to LA, both Boeing 767s, very large planes, moderately occupied.
They're full of fuel though.
Full of jet fuel. I mean, they're going across the country. And you want a little bit more than enough fuel to get you there in case there's strong headwinds or something like that. Flight 11 is hijacked over central Massachusetts at 8:14 a.m. So 15 minutes into their flight, they are hijacked and over Massachusetts, first turning northwest, then they turn south. So... Yeah, what they do is they go up until they see the Hudson River in Massachusetts, or I guess in New York at that time. They flew over Massachusetts, and then they see the Hudson, and they follow it into New York. That way they don't need to read any computers. They just look at the river and follow it all the way down. That was the idea, and that's what they did. American Airlines Flight 77, a Boeing 757 with 58 passengers and six crew members, departs 10 minutes late from Dulles in Washington, D.C. for L.A., again, fully loaded with lots of jet fuel. I'm talking thousands of pounds of jet fuel. At 8:20 a.m., five hijackers are aboard again. At 8:42, United Flight 93, a Boeing 757 with 37 passengers and seven crew members, departs 42 minutes late from Newark, in New Jersey, bound for San Francisco, again, with five hijackers, and again, full of jet fuel going all the way across the country. Between 8:42 and 8:46, approximately, Flight 175 is hijacked above northwest New Jersey, about 60 miles northwest of New York City, continuing southwest briefly before turning back northeast. 8:46, Flight 11 crashes into the north face of the North Tower, of the World Trade Center between floors 93 and 99. The aircraft enters the tower intact, so it didn't break apart before hitting the tower, smacks the tower, and with the North Tower, the really sad thing is, It took out all three emergency staircases that are located in the center of the building. So no one above the 93rd floor got out alive.
Right.
In North Tower. Flight 77 is so at 8:50. So that was at 8:46. Plane hits the building. Most people have no idea what size the aircraft was. They think it's a small aircraft that hit because it's actually happened before, believe it or not. In the early mid 40s, a U.S. bomber aircraft was flying in New York City during a dense fog. They don't have the advanced equipment on today's aircraft, and this bomber crashes into the Empire State Building. It's a incident not many people know about, and within a couple of weeks, the building's repaired. Of course, everybody on the two pilots on the aircraft are killed. The building's repaired. Nobody really thinks too much of it. It was just a tragic accident. That's what they thought happened again with the World Trade Center, the first building or the first plane crash. They said, "Oh my gosh, you know,
this is a tragedy."
Some poor guy in a Cessna. You know,
everyone's watching it. Like, yeah. Wow.
Very confused as to what's going on. So yeah, Flight 77 is hijacked above Southern Ohio, turning to the southeast at 8:54. Flight 77 is the one that crashes into the Pentagon in Northern Virginia. At 9:03 a.m., Flight 175, the second flight to take off and be hijacked, about 15 minutes after Flight 11, crashes into the south face of the South Tower, the 2 World Trade Center, between floors 77 and 85. So it hits much lower, the South Tower. Parts of the plane, including the starboard engine, leave the building from its east and north sides, falling to the ground 6 blocks away. And they recover the engine, and it literally flies straight through the building, basically, and comes out the other side, one of the engines. At 9:28, let's see.
I mean, yeah, you're talking about like planes going at least 500, 700 miles an hour. I don't know how.
They were going about 450 miles an hour.
400? Damn.
It was pretty freaking fast. Considering NASCARs go about 200 miles an hour.
Yeah, no, that's crazy.
Yeah. So Flight 93 takes off at 8:42. By 9:28, less than an hour later, Flight 93 is hijacked above Northern Ohio. Then, 9 minutes later, Flight 77 crashes into the western side of the Pentagon and starts a violent fire. At 9:45, U.S. airspace is shut down. Basically, we realized we were under attack, so all operating aircraft are ordered to land at the nearest airport. Obviously, it has never happened in U.S. history since or before that time. And I've actually seen a diagram of all of the planes that were in the air. There's literally hundreds of aircraft in the air over continental United States, and within like an hour, all of them are landed. I mean, that's a logistical nightmare for flight traffic controllers.
Holy crap, yeah. It's already the most stressful job in America. Yeah,
yeah, and you got to make sure every single plane lands. And then if you have any sort of miscommunication with one of those aircraft, they're going to assume it's been hijacked at this point. So at 9:57, 12 minutes after they shut down all flights, the passengers aboard Flight 93 begin to revolt against the hijackers in an attempt to take back the plane.
How did they? I just don't understand how they knew. Like, did they get text messages or something?
Who?
Flight 93.
Texting wasn't around in 2001. Didn't exist.
What? They had Nokia phones then, didn't they?
They didn't text, though. That wasn't a thing.
I guess I was watching some documentary and it was saying they probably had some like info ahead of time somehow.
So,
like, on the flight somehow.
Some of the passengers did have planes, and they did call their relatives, and their relatives told them about the World Trade Center, two planes hitting because both planes had hit at that time.
Right.
They realized we just turned back towards Washington, D.C.
Okay, that's what I was, that's what I was talking about. That right there. Okay, so they called. They were, like, calling and stuff. Okay.
Mm-hmm. One of the flight attendants knew, and a few of the passengers knew.
Time to revolt.
And took the most, you know, one of the most famous lines of the whole saga of 9/11 was "Let's roll." And that was one of the last words ever recorded by one of the Flight 93 passengers when they before they took over the cockpit. And so what happened on Flight 93 was they were hijacked. People were they just used box cutters. They just used little, you know, those little slide out box cutter knives. And they stabbed people. They stabbed flight attendants. I think they stabbed, you know, five people and cut them, sliced them. You know, pretty good little gouges. It's enough to make you disabled, right? You can't, like, fight someone if you're bleeding profusely. But you can still get that through security at the time. And...
Yeah, yeah. No one remembers, you know?
There was no TSA.
Yeah, no one remembers how crazy lax security is, you know?
I mean, even after 9/11, you didn't have to take off your shoes. Right. The shoe bomber hadn't happened yet.
Yeah.
I mean, it puts it into perspective for sure. So what happened was they sliced these people with box cutters. They get into the cockpit, kill the pilots, and lock the door behind them. Cockpit doors do not lock anymore for this reason. Pilots are allowed to carry pistols with them for this reason. And... there's a whole lot of other, obviously there's tons of other safety measures that have been implemented since 9/11. So what happened was the hijackers turned the plane around. The passengers that have phones, cell phones at the time, once they get low enough to enter cell tower range, they start calling people, leaving voicemails to their loved ones saying, "I'm going to die. This is, you know, the last words I'm going to speak to my family members." So they tell them how much they love them. The ones that are lucky enough to speak with a family member, they realize what's going on, and they get together and they say, like, we've got to do something. It's either we're going to die anyway, and we can either try and take over the plane and try and land it and try and live, or we can, you know, take the plane down before we get to the Capitol, because they were going to fly that plane right into the Capitol building or the White House.
Right.
Now, by then, we had begun to scramble jets, and there were jets headed towards Flight 93. They were going to shoot it down anyway before it got to the Capitol, most likely, I think. And so anyway, the passengers get the little food beverage cart, ram it into the door, bust open the door, fight like hell with the terrorists, and the plane ends up crashing over Shanksville, Pennsylvania. And so that's basically what happened on Flight 93 is every single passenger on that plane ended up being a hero. So that was at 9:57. At 9:59, 2 minutes later, the South Tower of the World Trade Center collapses 56 minutes after the impact of Flight 175. Now, these towers built in the very early 70s were designed to withstand an impact from the largest plane at the time, which was, I believe, a Boeing 737, just released, biggest plane of the time, you know, not nearly as big as a 757 or 767. And it was meant to withstand the impact of an aircraft slamming into it, not thousands and thousands of pounds of jet fuel burning and then everything inside the building burning. It wasn't as safe against fire as a lot of conspiracy theorists want to make it out to be. The fires were definitely hot enough to melt steel, and the flame retardant material on the steel pillars was supposed to be, I think, like 3 inches thick. It was only a quarter inch thick in some places. So they kind of cut costs with the flame insulation on the steel beams. South Tower collapses at 9:03. No, I'm sorry. At 9:59, only 56 minutes after the plane struck, at 10:03, Flight 93 crashed by its hijackers as a result of fighting in the cockpit, 80 miles southeast of Pittsburgh in Somerset County, Pennsylvania. Okay. At 10:28, the North Tower collapses 1 hour and 42 minutes after the impact of Flight 11. The Marriott Hotel, located at the base of the two towers, is also destroyed, of course. And the firefighters in the building at the time believed that they had at least 3 hours, at least 3 to 5 hours before the buildings even
collapsed or messed up. Yeah.
Yeah, before it was.
That's crazy, though, because no, I mean, I guess you can't really know for sure, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way. I mean, you can get an engineer on the line, but there's not going to be an answer he'll have because he's not testing for that.
Yeah, and they had, you know, each tower had its own full-time engineer.
Yeah.
Including one for the Marriott, one for the tower itself. Full-time engineers that knew every little bit of the building, and they said, look, we should have time. These fires shouldn't be hot enough to burn.
It's crazy, dude.
So at 10:50, this is almost done. At 10:50, 5 stories of part of the Pentagon collapsed due to the fire, the raging fire inside the Pentagon. And at 5:20 p.m., 7 World Trade Center, a 47-story building, collapses.
There's a documentary where the guy on the 93rd floor, there's one random dude on the South Tower. So it hadn't been hit yet. You know, it was hit second or whatever. So the first one gets hit, and they told everyone, be calm, stay where you are, you know, don't move, you know, kind of thing. And he was already on his feet anyway. And he was like, nah. He bounced. He was like, this is crazy. I'm out.
Mm-hmm.
So he lived. But it's just like, it's just weird. It's human, like, instincts, I guess, are weird. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
How do you not think, like, in your head, like, whoa, what's going on? This is crazy. I'm out. Well, apparently, dude, Marriott people, they couldn't even feel it. Like, they were like, oh, they heard something, and they saw some ruffling fucking papers outside. Mm-hmm. I'm like, what the heck? Like, people, like, there was a lawyer that was staying there in a case the next day or whatever. He was like, yeah, I didn't. In the documentary, he's just like, yeah, I saw some papers outside flying around. I thought maybe one of the windows blew out because the Hudson River always has winds that come in.
Hmm.
And he was like, maybe that happened. I don't know. He just kept about it. He took a shower. He was like, oh, whatever. I'm like, what the heck? A plane just rammed into a building right next door.
And that's kind of shocking because
how do you not feel that?
The building shook for, I think, reports of about 4 minutes.
Yeah, this
of shaking.
So the first building, right? Mm-hmm. The south building shook.
North Tower is the first one struck.
Okay, so the North Tower was shaking for that long?
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy, dude. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know how they wouldn't.
So my uncle has actually been to he went to the World Trade Centers, obviously, in the 90s, and he was at the very top. I mean, on the roof of the World Trade Center, not the observation deck, but the roof.
Yeah.
And he said that it was a moderately windy day, not like crazy windy.
Yeah.
And that he could feel the building swaying,
dude. Yes, dude.
About 4 feet in either direction.
Right. And that can happen. And that's why I'm thinking, like, how does this guy not feel it? Yeah, they're made for it. It's like bridges. When you're on a bridge, it, like, kind of, like, does that weird wavy crap. Mm-hmm.
Suspension
feel it,
bridges,
like,
especially.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. This is normal.
Mm-hmm.
It's just weird to me that he would say he can't feel it. I'm like, what the heck? Yeah. Anyway, that guy made it because he's like, yeah, you guys are telling me to stay here, but why would I do that? You know?
Yeah. So that's the basic timeline of what happened.
Yeah.
Right. And that is what happened. And whether, you know, conspiracies aside, you can say, like, government knew about it, they didn't know, it was an inside job, outside job, whatever.
Well, I don't think the government knowing about it is necessarily a conspiracy. The thing is that even if, like, Pentagon or whoever the heck intelligence agencies knew about this thing that might happen, even if that was a thing, there's not a way. Like, I don't know how you prepare for that unless you know, like, days in advance. What if they just knew, like, hours in advance? They're like, oh, this might happen. Or what if they just knew one day in advance? You don't know. You have no idea. You know what I mean? Hmm. If they knew months in advance, they might be like, you might, I don't know, what would you do? You don't want to cause panic. So you're going to tell your people and be like, yeah, evacuate that building on the 11th.
So,
you know?
They didn't know the original plan. That was kind of conceived in the early mid-90s. They've been thinking about this for years.
Because you always think about attacks like that.
Oh, of course.
Just
yeah.
Like the COVID, like the pandemic. We have, like, freaking war games or whatever.
The original plan was
the COVID
was to attack about 19 different buildings all across the United States. from San Francisco to Dallas to Chicago to New York to Washington, D.C., Miami. Like, they wanted to go everywhere all at once the same day. No one felt safe. It ended up only being in New York and, of course, Pennsylvania and the Pentagon and Washington, D.C., Virginia, technically. But they ended up not having the resources. Plus, if they would have expanded to that scope, they definitely would have been foiled because, I mean, you've got to get people all over the country instead of, what, two different airports? Because it was...
yeah, but by the sounds of it, it wouldn't have New stopped them. Because, like, airports didn't give a crap back then, dude. You know? There wasn't like, random screenings and crap. I feel like they would have made it. There's some random people still, but they're all across America instead of just in New York. I don't know. But the fact that they wouldn't have that many people. Like, Al-Qaeda, whatever, how big were they?
What do you mean?
How many people did they have in that freaking group? Do you know?
In America or
no, just globally? In that group totally.
Thousands?
You think so? Thousands. Okay, I was expecting you to say like tens of thousands or whatever.
Across the
they're
world.
They're not a big army at all. I'm trying to say that they're nothing compared to other armies. That's what I'm trying
they
to
say. They were probably in the tens of thousands.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean Al-Qaeda, they did have some weapons and they obviously had a safe place in Afghanistan. The Taliban gave them, you know, safe harbor in Afghanistan, the only place in the world that they were basically allowed to stay. I mean, these guys got kicked out of Sudan. That's how brutal the Al-Qaeda is. They got kicked out of one of the worst countries on the planet. I mean, if you don't know about Sudan, it's a terrible country. So, long story short, bad place to be.
It's ran by terrorists, kind of.
Well, dictators.
Dictators, yeah. that are like really just brutal.
Mm-hmm. So, a background. If y'all want to get into it, let's get into it, because we're going back. So this is also from Wikipedia real quick, and this is bullet points.
This is in order to debunk all your conspiracy theories.
The thing is, though, I'm very open-minded, and I love listening to conspiracy theories.
Dude, we're all about it on the show.
You know that I don't think that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone killing JFK.
No way.
He even pulled the trigger, which I have my doubts.
We all wear tinfoil hats here, man. You're good.
But 9/11
with holes in it.
Yeah,
that's what I like to say. We wear tinfoil hats with holes in them. You know.
But
let the crazy escape every once in a while.
The official narrative of 9/11 is what happened. There was no like government let it happen. There was no
government did it. People like literally think that we did that.
Yeah. And those people have no idea what the hell they're talking about.
Well, I don't know. Do you see MK Ultra? You see that kind of stuff, and you're like, well,
yeah. But
we're pretty sinister beings, you know.
I agree.
But that's like
totally.
That's also an internal CIA thing that happened.
Yeah.
Not necessarily a whole freaking public people. Like everyone that died in MK Ultra was pretty much an agent that signed waivers and actually agreed to it somehow, which just sucks. But I'm just saying.
Yeah. So, yeah, after all of the research I've done in 9/11, and I've dove in hard in my college days, I would do nothing but look and read and watch and read and be crazy open-minded about conspiracy theories. And at one point, I never thought it was an inside job, but at one point I was like, the government destroyed their own buildings with Building 7.
Building 7, yeah, we need to talk about that.
We'll definitely get to it. But people, 9/11 didn't happen in a vacuum, and it didn't happen out of nowhere. Like, it had been building for a decade prior, at least. And they had been planning it since the early mid-90s, 93, 95. I mean, there was another World Trade Center bombing by the same people in 93. A lot of people don't even know that, especially a lot of people our age, don't even know that there was a bombing on the World Trade Center, a truck bomb that happened in the basement parking garage of World Trade Center. I think it was, I can't remember if it was South or North Tower. but it blew up and killed 6 people. And it could have been way worse. They were trying to take down the building. And they were successful in the detonation, and it just wasn't powerful enough to do that much damage, and there weren't that many people in the parking garage at the time. So, fortunately, not that many people died in the first World Trade Center attack of 93. But here is the long-form background.
Starting long. Oh,
yeah. 1931. So, Mohammed bin Awad bin Laden founds the Saudi Bin Laden Group, which grows to be one of the largest construction firms in the Middle East and makes him a billionaire.
Construction, huh?
Mm-hmm. That's how the Bin Ladens got their wealth. The family of Bin Ladens got their wealth. It's construction. They built roads, bridges, totally above board, good business. I mean, the Osama Bin Laden's father was a savvy business person. That's all he was. He just wanted to be a business person, make money, and move on. That's what he did. In 1939, the world's New York World Fair includes an exhibit entitled the World Trade Center. And they start getting these ideas of, you know, we should build a center in New York City that is, you know, a center for global trade, right? World Trade Center. You know, just like the name suggests. In 1950, Saeed Qutbi returns to Egypt from a 2-year visit of the United States, sponsored by the Ministry of Education, and joins the Muslim Brotherhood due to his disgust towards Western culture. So this guy, Saeed Qutbi, from Egypt, after visiting the United States, he's like, oh my gosh, these women are wearing... You can see their ankles. Like, what the heck? This is 1950, and he's upset with, you know, the Western decadence and Western liberalism compared to just harsh, you know, Muslim...
Tradition, culture.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm trying to think of the Sharia law.
Oh.
In 1951 through 65, Qutbi writes a book, Fi Zilal al-Quran, while in prison for an assassination attempt against... Abdel Nasser. The book claims, and I believe Abdel Nasser, I think he was the second president of Egypt. He calls for Islamist resolution against secularism, including Arab nationalism. So at the time, Egypt was much more secularism. They wore suits and tie. They were much more of a Western country at that time in the early 50s. The book claims that Israel and the Arab states of the Persian Gulf are American satellite states and calls for an Islamist revolution against secularism, including Arab nationalism, socialism, and liberal democracy. So, Sharia or death. They're against communism, they're against socialism, they're against, obviously everybody's against fascism besides certain Italians, and they're definitely against Western democracy and Western values. They still, to this day... largely in the Middle East, do not comport to Western values. I mean, Saudi women only got the right to drive like 2 years ago.
Right.
I
mean, we're seeing that now with Afghanistan, the way they
Do their stuff, the Taliban. You know? Yeah, absolutely. The book also concludes that any Muslims who support secularism are takfir. I don't know what that means. It doesn't say. I'm guessing that means like they're not true Muslims. The book becomes highly influential towards Islamic terrorists. It's like becomes their Bible. On March 10th, 1957, this is a guess. We don't actually know the exact day on the, I think it's like called the Julian calendar, basically our Western calendar, what day Osama bin Laden was born. But around March 10th, 1957, he is born in Riyadh, which is Saudi Arabia. 1959, David Rockefeller revives the idea of a World Trade Center. And they're like, we should build this thing. And then they kind of get into planning of it. In 1964, Minoru Yamasaki's design for the original World Trade Center, including the Twin Towers, is unveiled by the Port Authority of New York. So this is a Japanese architect who's coincidentally and ironically afraid of heights, wants to build the two tallest buildings in the world. And it's funny, there's a little, there's an anecdote kind of in New York, is saying that they had regarding the Twin Towers. They were like New York City, because a lot of New Yorkers did not like the Twin Towers when they first came out. They said they're like, New York City, home of beautiful buildings like the Chrysler Building and the Empire State Building and the two boxes that they came in. I think that's pretty funny.
Because they're taller than them.
Well, it's because they're big, square.
No, I know, boring. But aren't they taller? Aren't the Twin Towers the tallest?
Yeah, they're the tallest buildings in the world.
So they could actually fit. They could actually fit this.
They actually could. They, like, width-wise and everything. That's a perfect little thing. In 1966, construction begins on the original World Trade Center. And also in 1966, Sayyid Qutbi is executed in Egypt, and his brother Muhammad Qutbi flees to Saudi Arabia. He acquires a teaching position at King Abdul
Aziz. Why the heck was he executed?
University in Jeddah. What?
Why was he executed?
Because he is speaking out against the Egyptian government.
Oh.
And is basically like committing treason, actively committing treason against the Egyptian government. Egypt's not a perfect country by this point either. They're shutting down to
clearly, sand. Clearly.
In 1970, the North Tower is finished. In 1973, the South Tower is finished. There's also a new government, a coup d'etat in Afghanistan. So there's obviously a lot of unstable destabilization in Afghanistan in the mid-70s, early 70s, 73. 76 through 1980, bin Laden is radicalized by Qutbi while attending King Abdulaziz University for Business Administration.
He's radicalized.
Jeez. Bin Laden was, he was a normal kid, quiet, reserved, very thoughtful, very, very like soft-spoken but intelligent. He had mediocre grades. Because he was, you know, focused on social life and that sort of thing. He was very, very good socially and very, like, very warm. He was a very warm person. Even, like, journalists that interviewed him after he became, like, a terrorist said that he would smile at you from across the room.
It's so weird.
Feel welcome.
After he became a terrorist, there can be a journalist that interviews
Well, he
him.
Wants to get his message out to Westerners, for sure, to everybody.
You guys are terrible. Dress differently.
Yeah, that's not exactly why he was pissed off, but
yeah, right.
In 78, Khan is overthrown in the Sour Revolution, and the Soviet Union invades Afghanistan a year later. So Khan was the guy that took over Afghanistan after Mohammad Zahir Shah is overthrown. In 79, a year later. So in 79, bin Laden travels to Afghanistan to assist the Sunni Mujahideen in the Afghan-Soviet War. So the Soviets invade Afghanistan, and there's these religious leaders, local kind of religious leaders, called Mujahideen, that are fighting the Soviets. And bin Laden is like, what am I doing in Saudi being this rich kid? I need to go fight for my Sunni brethren in Afghanistan and get these Soviets out of here because communism is horrible. And the United States becomes concerned over Islamic extremism after the Iranian Revolution and the Iran hostage crisis. That's all in 1979. And Jimmy Carter's president of the United States at this time. In 1981, bin Laden's future deputy, Ayman al-Zawahiri, the leader of Jama'at al-Jihad, is arrested for his role in the assassination of Anwar Sadat, the president of Egypt, and imprisoned for 3 years. He helped plan it. So the assassination of Anwar Sadat, who was the president of Egypt at the time, happened because Anwar Sadat made an agreement with Israel during the what's called the Camp David Accords. So Jimmy Carter sees that Egypt and Israel are having this conflict over the Sinai Peninsula, and there's a crisis called the Suez Canal crisis, where no ships can get through the Suez Canal between Egypt and... so basically the Mediterranean Sea, southeast of that is the Suez Canal and the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt. And if you go past that, you're going to go past the, I think it's the Dead Sea or the Red, I think it's the Red Sea actually. And then you can go through that and around to the Indian Ocean. So it's a huge trade path. You know, if you're going from Australia by sea to Italy, that's where you got to go. Or even to just Europe in general. Like going over land doesn't make any sense. So going through the ocean, it's a huge trade port. And so to resolve this conflict between Israel and Egypt, Jimmy Carter invites them to Camp David, and Anwar Sadat and I can't remember the prime minister of Israel at the time, but they all get together. They have this huge peace agreement, and both the leader of Israel and Anwar Sadat get the Nobel Peace Prize for this. The Israelis give back the Sinai Peninsula, which is a big chunk of territory. The Israelis give it back to Egypt as long as the Suez Canal remains open and for Western trade. And everybody's happy. It's a very like copacetic agreement. And, yeah. And for that reason, for Anwar Sadat placating to and pleasing Westerners, like, you know, the quote unquote evil Zionists in Israel, he gets assassinated by radical Sunni terrorists. And they don't just like go up and poison him. While he's at a speech, they come up guns blazing, like 10 guys with AKs just mow down Sadat and I think 9 or 10 other people. Just mow them down. Tons of bullets flying everywhere. So that was the assassination of Anwar Sadat. In, I think, 1980 or 81. By 83, the Beirut barracks bombings targeting the multinational force in Lebanon during the Lebanese Civil War provides inspiration for bin Laden. And the Beirut barracks bombings, I want to say, yeah, so two truck bombs struck buildings in Beirut, housing American and French service members. The attack killed 307 people, 241 U.S. and 58 French military personnel, 6 civilians, and the two attackers. What they did was they had this big truck. They drove it straight inside the building and detonated it. This was enough explosive not only to kill everybody, but it blew the building, the entire building, up into the air, and then it collapsed back down and flattened.
Holy crap.
It was a huge explosion. And, yeah, big old, I mean, huge terrorist attack, 1983. And this begins to inspire bin Laden. He's like, wow, this is a very effective. Like, the Americans are out of Lebanon now. This might be a good idea. This might be a good response to American occupation. In October of 84, bin Laden co-founds a network, the Maktab al-Qidamat, with Abdullah Yusuf Assam in Afghanistan and Pakistan to recruit Muslims for the Afghan resistance. Eventually, Matt bin Laden and Assam kind of part ways, and bin Laden eventually goes on to form what's known as the base, or al-Qaeda in Arabic. In 1986, bin Laden travels to Afghanistan to lead MAC forces in combat. In February of 87, al-Qaeda establishes its first training camps in Afghanistan, which are probably still there today. In May, May 25th, yeah. 1987, bin Laden withstands a Soviet attack during the Battle of Jaji, establishing his reputation in the Arab world. So he's getting a reputation as a fighter, a freedom fighter for Afghan freedom in the late 80s. In December 8th, and during all this time, bin Laden is a millionaire. He can fund al-Qaeda. He can, he has access to all this construction equipment because he still owns the construction business. So his father, they have like, I want to say like 20, 30 kids. His dad, a lot of kids. because he's got four wives. Because if you're a Sunni Muslim, you can have up to four wives. So he's got dozens of kids.
Wow.
All of the women get, I think, 3% of the company each, which is still like a couple $1 million a piece. And all of the sons, I think, get like 10% or something like that each. So the sons get a lot more than the daughters, obviously. But the father gives...
obviously, for their culture, yeah.
Yeah, the father still gives the daughters quite a bit of money. And Osama bin Laden takes that money and takes those resources, and he runs the company for a while. He's building roads for these countries in exchange for kind of safe harbor.
So he wasn't, was he running Al-Qaeda yet or not?
So Al-Qaeda was not a thing yet.
Okay. So his dad's not like, no, you can't do that. Like, I
think his dad was dead at this time.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
his dad died, leaves him all this money, all these resources, this big company. Says, hey, you can build roads, you can build bridges, you can build tunnels and caves wherever you want. You've got the resources, you've got the money.
Yeah.
Whatever you want to do. So December 8th, 1987, the first Intifada begins in Palestine. Bin Laden expresses vocal support for the conflict and begins to advocate in favor of jihad against the West. Jihad is just religious war, and Intifada means killing the infidels. 1988, Osama bin Laden forms a computer database of Islamist militants founding Al-Qaeda. He declares that Muslims must protect the holy sites of Mecca and Medina from foreign control as a religious duty. So remember, this is an important point. I'm going through a lot of bullets, and you can kind of gloss over this, but this is an important point. 1988, Osama bin Laden forms Al-Qaeda in a computer database. He declares that Muslims must protect the holy sites of Mecca and Medina, and this is in Saudi Arabia, from foreign control as a religious duty. Like, this must be done, or you're not a Muslim.
Huh.
February 15th, 1989, the Soviet Army...
add a rule to your religion. It's kind of weird.
Well, it's... I mean, if you are a true Muslim, you are going to defend your holy sites. It's like a Jew or a Christian defending Jerusalem. Like, if I was a Christian living in Israel and anybody wanted to invade Jerusalem, I'd kill him.
Right.
Hands down.
Right.
Because those are the most holy sites to the Christian religion. I mean, those are literally the streets that Jesus walked around on.
Right.
February 15th, 1989, the Soviet Army completes its withdrawal from Afghanistan, and bin Laden advocates transforming Al-Qaeda into a global network to fund jihad, which he kind of succeeds in. Those other Al-Qaeda members in, I want to say, the Philippines, and then they start to go across the Middle East and... Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, Pakistan. Then they creep over to Africa and Sudan and all around there. Assam prefers to focus on the Afghan Civil War and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So that's kind of where they split ways, and Osama begins to really form this Al-Qaeda into a global network, and Assam, his partner, splits ways and just says, we need to focus on Afghanistan and Israel and the Palestinians.
Right.
May through June 89, Al-Qaeda forces are badly defeated by the Afghan National Army in the Battle of Jalalabad, leading to a drop in membership and reorientation of tactics. June 30th, 1989, Omar al-Bashir and Hassan al-Turabi's National Islamic Front seize control of Sudan in a coup d'etat. Al-Turabi would invite bin Laden to stay in the country. So bin Laden gets defeated in Afghanistan, and he then moves to Sudan in Africa. It's in Eastern Africa, kind of by Kenya, Somalia, Tanzania, yeah, that area. So that's June 30th. By November of 89 is a busy year for bin Laden. Bin Laden returns to Saudi Arabia, and Prince Turki bin Faisal rejects his offer to send Al-Qaeda to overthrow the communist government in South Yemen. So the Saudis and the Yemenis have been fighting for decades. They're still fighting today. And Bin Laden says, hey, you know, I've got this, I've got these soldiers, I've got these trained fighters that fought with me in Afghanistan. They're very loyal to me. They're loyal to Sunni Muslims. Saudi Arabia is full of Sunni Muslims. Let us fight for you, your highness, to get rid of these, you know, Yemenis that are causing you all this trouble. The Saudis reject him because they realize that Bin Laden's not really a good guy. He's more out for himself at this point.
It's kind of weird whenever that happens. A terrorist group comes up to you and is like, hey, you know, let me help you guys.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, they just want to be recognized, you know?
Yeah.
They just want to be recognized as an actual thing, just like right now with the Taliban.
Mm-hmm. So in November 24th, 1989, Assam, who is Bin Laden's kind of wingman in Al-Qaeda, but they're having these tensions. Assam is assassinated in a car bombing, and this allows Bin Laden to take over Al-Qaeda. So he's like, okay, my global network's coming. We're all about jihad. We're all about terrorism, essentially. This is the tactic we're going to use to as a means to an end. May 22nd, 1990, the governments of South and North Yemen merged together into the Unified Republic of Yemen. Bin Laden runs afoul of the Saudi Interior Ministry for attempting to violently disrupt the unification process. So the unification of Yemen is going to bring peace to the Yemeni-Saudi conflict, and Bin Laden does not want that because they're communists, and he doesn't want any communism in the Arab world whatsoever. August 2nd, 1990, Ba'athist Iraq invades and annexes Kuwait. Now, remember what I said about Mecca and Medina and how they're not going to, they have to defend those to the death. So the Ba'athists in Iraq were basically Arab socialists. And fearing an Iraqi threat to Eastern Province oil fields, King Fahd rapidly accepts American military assistance to the opposition of Bin Laden. So, King Fahd in Kuwait is like, we need help against these Ba'athists and Saddam Hussein in Iraq. They're invading us, and they want our oil. So the Iraqis annex Kuwait. Kuwait's a tiny little country, and Iraq's a big country with lots of resources, big army. They totally take over Kuwait in a matter of a couple of days. Now Iraq and the Ba'athists, the socialists, have control over 20% of global oil production. So these guys are going to get rich real fast. We're talking like Venezuela rich, then socialism, then the country collapses. King Fahd really needs American military might to just get rid of these Iraqis.
Right.
America's like, hell yeah, we need somebody to bomb. Let's do it.
Oh my God. Military industrial complex. Let's go.
Hell yeah. So George H.W. Bush, who's president at the time, was like, hell yeah, how many tanks you want? And this pisses off Bin Laden pretty bad, because guess where the American troops are going to sit? Because Kuwait's like, it's a tiny country. You can't just have all these tens of thousands of American troops that are, you know, that we got to have an area to set up. So Iraq is here. Kuwait's right here. And guess what's roll right here? Saudi Arabia. Mecca and Medina are right up there in Saudi Arabia. And guess where all of our troops go? Right on Muslim holy lands.
Yeah.
And we're talking not just white guys with short hair. We're talking women in uniform too.
Yeah.
And Bin Laden is pissed that there are women without coverings in military uniform on Muslim holy lands defending Sunni Muslims. He's like, this is the opposite of Islam.
It's literally everything that he's against, yeah.
Absolutely everything he's against. It's Westerners. It's women. It's women in the military.
Holy
and it's
dude. That's crazy.
Yeah, you can see why he's
gets
more and more pissed.
Yeah, that right there would just trigger something, you know?
Oh, he gets triggered. In September of 1990, Bin Laden makes an offer to the Sultan bin Abdulaziz al-Saud to defend Saudi Arabia. So he's like, yo, Saudis, I got you. I'm Saudi. I used to be Saudi. What happened? Like, I will help you defend against, like, we don't need these Americans. We don't need these Westerners. Put them aside. Don't let them in our holy lands. We gotta defend Mecca Medina against these people. Not invite them over because the Baptists come. And they're like, nah, we don't need you, Bin Laden. Go away. You're a terrorist. Go away. And rejected twice. He's pissed. He becomes embittered by the intervention of non-Islamic troops from the U.S.-led international coalition in the Gulf War. So, this coalition is like, gosh, I should know this, but I'm going to say it's like 35 countries. I mean, we're talking tons and tons of countries. Like, Canada's involved in Desert Storm. And it's led by the U.S., obviously, because we have the best military infrastructure, communications and whatnot, equipment. And yeah, Bin Laden is like, this is the worst. This is like my nightmare. It's like just his nightmare. November 5th, 1990, El Said Nasser commits the assassination of Mayor Kahan in New York Marriott East Side. So this is back to New York City, okay? This radical Islamist terrorist goes and assassinates I don't want to call him necessarily right wing, but a very conservative Westerner. I think he was a Hasidic Jew. Don't quote me on that. He was Jewish for sure. And this is the first Islamist terrorist attack in the United States. First one, November 5th, 1990. The FBI subsequently finds documents linking the attack to Al-Qaeda, making it the organization's first involvement in attacks in the United States. And this guy is Kahani, the guy that was assassinated, was a Zionist, and I mean that in like a definitional way. He was for the state of Israel and promoted Israel over Palestine and hardcore Islamists wanted him gone. And so Al-Qaeda sent out a plot to assassinate him, and they were successful. It was a pretty dramatic assassination as well. The guy goes up, the assassin, Nasser, fires two shots very close range with a .357 Magnum and hits Kahane in the neck. And after Nasser, the assassin, runs off, I can't remember what authority he was, but it was a policeman of some kind, chases him, gets in a gunfight in the middle of New York streets with this guy. They have a shootout, and the officer gets hit in the chest, but has a bulletproof vest on, so it deflects and hit and gets lodged in his shoulder. But he manages to shoot Nasser in the neck as well. So both the assassin and the assassinated both get shot in the neck. The assassin lives, and Kahane dies. He's assassinated. But the ironic thing is they are both in the same hospital, in the same room, just feet apart, their beds, their hospital beds. So you've got assassin and assassin victim right next to each other.
Hello, this is an ad. And if you don't like that, that's fine. But trust me, it's good info for you. You have to have a podcast hosting platform if you want to start your own podcast. And that is actually one of the questions that I get asked the most often. It's not politics. It's not society or culture. It's how do I start a podcast? Well, this is how you freaking do it. You start with Blueberry. You can start with SoundCloud if you want. You can start with Anchor if you want because it's free. You can also start with Podbean. But let me tell you something. I've tried all three of those and they do not work that well. Whenever it comes to the analytics department, they do not do anything for you. They don't show you your stats. They don't let you look at Spotify stats separately or iTunes stats separately on their own because technically it's not your podcast. It's theirs. And that's what this boils down to. Blueberry lets you use your own podcast however you like. They only let you use their service for hosting. It's all it is. It's not a here's my content, do whatever you want with the type of thing. It's a here's my content, please store it in a safe place. And that is all they do for you. The other thing they add is they give you a plugin for your website. on WordPress. So I have a WordPress website for our stuff, our content, all of everything we do. It's toastercreations.com. So this is like a double whammy. Two ads in one, bro. Anyway, if you go to that site, you'll see all of our posts are also our podcast episodes. That's how they do it. Blueberry lets me post a blog post right up onto my website, and immediately it's a podcast episode, and it goes to all the podcast platforms automatically. That's what Blueberry does for you. And right now, if you go and sign up and use our promo code STAY-TOASTY, you get one free month to check it out. See how you like it. If you don't like it, well, then you can stop and you don't have any commitments. There's no contract on this, guys. It's month to month, no matter what. That's what's beautiful. So check it out. Let us know what you think. And if you don't like it, well, then suit yourself. Back to the show.
Damn, dude.
Pretty interesting. In April of 91, Bin Laden moves to Sudan and begins expanding Al-Qaeda using legitimate businesses as front organization. So he basically starts building roads in Sudan, uses his profits to build Al-Qaeda in Sudan. 92, Bin Laden begins to target U.S. military forces in the Arabian Peninsula and the Horn of Africa, which is like Somalia, as well as to consider alliances with Shiite Iranian-backed organizations such as Hezbollah. So Hezbollah is kind of this loosely organized group in the Middle East, and they are basically funded by Iran. It's Iran's kind of a proxy terrorist organization. You know, Iran is famously the world's leading sponsor of terror, leading state sponsor of terror, and Hezbollah are their henchmen. It's like kind of their shadow army. They're Schutzstaffel. April 27, 1992, the Democratic Republic of Afghanistan collapses. Surprise, surprise. After I'm not even going to try out that name. Afghanistan can't build a government. Let's just put it like that. December 29th, 1992, Al-Qaeda attacks U.S. military forces for the first time in Yemen, hotel bombings in Aden. So not the last time they will be attacking U.S. service members in Yemen.
Yeah, but we're still there because of why? We're still there because we're fighting the Baathists or whatever?
No, in Yemen, we are there because they have a military port where, or not a military port, but a naval port where our ships can refuel.
Oh, okay, cool. So it's simple.
In Aden.
Yeah,
yep.
Sweet.
February 26, 1993, Ramzi Youssef carries out the 1993 World Trade Center bombings. So, that gets me to our cast of characters. Cast of characters, here we go. Osama bin Laden, if you don't know who that is, go kill yourself. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is the mastermind of 9/11. And he is the uncle of Ramzi Youssef. Now, Ramzi Youssef is the mastermind behind the 1993 World Trade Center bombings. And they grew up together. They kind of radicalized with each other. Both of these guys are smart. Real smart dudes. They both go to college and both become... I think Ramzi Youssef becomes a electrical engineer. That's what he gets his degree in. Which I can't even do basic electrical work, let alone be an electrical engineer. And then Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, KSM for short, as he's commonly known, goes to school, and I think he becomes like a mechanical engineer or something like that. But they're both really smart guys. So that's kind of how they're related. George W. Bush, he was the U.S. president during 9/11. Dick Cheney, U.S. vice president during 9/11. Ramzi Youssef, again, KSM's nephew, perpetrated the 1993 World Trade Center bombings. Larry Silverstein was the owner of the World Trade Center buildings at the time of 9/11 and the attacks. Donald Trump, real estate magnate, and who became the 45th president of the United States. Mohammed Atta was one of bin Laden's closest friends and allies, and was, I believe he helped hijack Flight 11 and crash into the World Trade Center. Anwar Sadat, we kind of went over him. He's the president of Egypt, and was present during the Camp David Accords with the Prime Minister of Israel. For some reason, I can't remember his name at the time. And President Jimmy Carter in the late 70s, very late 70s. And then Bill Clinton, of course, he was the 42nd president after George H.W. Bush, who was the 41st president. So it was George H.W. Bush from 1989 to 1993. And then Bill Clinton was from 93 to 2000. And then George W. Bush was from 2000 to 2008. And, of course, we had Barack Obama, then Donald Trump, and now some old guy. Let's see here. So Ramzi Youssef carries out the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. October 3rd through 4th, 1993, 18 American servicemen are killed by Al-Qaeda-trained forces in the Battle of Mogadishu. This event is commonly known as Black Hawk Down. And, let's see, I've got a little Wikipedia page about that, just real quick. So, this was fought 3rd and 4th of October 1993 in Mogadishu, Somalia, between forces of the United States supported by the UN, and they were fighting Somali militiamen that were basically trained by Al-Qaeda, led by Osama bin Laden. That was kind of our first little taste of fighting in the Middle East, really, as Islamic extremists. We had 19 Americans killed. The biggest deal with Black Hawk Down was we kind of go in thinking, oh, it's just a bunch of ragtag African militants. Like, we'll send in a couple Black Hawks and they'll be gone overnight. Like, not a big deal. That was Bill Clinton's whole... That was his first foray into foreign conflict. And he just gets elected, remember, in 1992. And he just... becomes president in January of 93, and this is October of 93, so it's not too far out. He's 9 months into his presidency, and he's like, I don't want to go too hard. I don't want to start any wars in Somalia, but like JFK and the Bay of Pigs, it's just weak sauce. I mean, too little, and our forces get overwhelmed there, and we lose the Battle of Mogadishu, and essentially... There's a point where the Somalians that are dragging dead U.S. soldiers through the streets of Mogadishu. Like, it's a humiliating, gut-wrenching loss. It's horrible. And Al-Qaeda is cheering at this, and we realize, like, wow, these guys have it a little more together than we thought. And if we are going to go in, we got to go in with overwhelming force. Okay, so it's kind of a lesson learned for Bill Clinton and the U.S. as far as we got to take this a little bit more seriously, which we didn't. We did not.
Which we didn't.
We didn't learn our lesson, unfortunately. So that was the Battle of Mogadishu, Black Hawk Down, that incident. And it's linked. That the 9/11 is linked to Black Hawk Down. A lot of people don't, like, they can't connect those dots because they, you know, one happened in Somalia, Africa, Mogadishu, and the other one happened in New York City. Like, what's the link there? And bin Laden was against us in both occasions. April 9th, 1994, about a year later, less than a year, it was 8 months later, bin Laden's Saudi citizenship is revoked because he's training these militants in Somalia, he's training these militants in Sudan, he's destabilizing Yemen, and this is all against Saudi's interests. Saudi Arabia quietly and slowly wants to modernize and bring in good relations with the West, because guess who has a lot of money? The West. And guess who has a lot of oil? The Saudis. And guess who needs to sell that oil to the West? Because the USSR at this time is broke. They got no money. They're not buying anything from anybody in the Middle East. So, in order to help normalize relations with America, the Saudis say, hey, we need your help. We'll let you stay here during Operation Desert Storm. We want to trade oil with you. We want to normalize relations with you. And bin Laden is totally against that. So they're like, we got to separate ourselves from bin Laden because bin Laden's against the West and we need the West. And the West doesn't like bin Laden and vice versa.
Right.
So... They revoke his citizenship. Now, the funny thing is, now, I think Family Guy has this, like, quote about 9/11 that's like, You know, 15 of the hijackers were Saudi. I think 2 were from Lebanon, 1 was from Egypt, and 2 were from Kuwait or something like that. Something like that. But the majority, the vast majority, were Saudi of the hijackers themselves. And then Bin Laden, of course, was Saudi originally. Now, he would never say, like, oh, I'm a Saudi. Like, no, Bin Laden wasn't a Saudi nationalist. He was a Muslim first, for sure. So were all the other hijackers. He was a radical Muslim. And they wouldn't identify as Saudi nationals. And the Saudi government and the state of Saudi Arabia wouldn't recognize them as citizens. Like, they revoked his citizenship. So the whole Family Guy quote is like, so a bunch of Saudis gathered in Afghanistan and attacked us in New York. And then I think Stewie's like, so we should invade Iraq? And it's like, okay, you're like grossly misinterpreting the situation, and you're it's a very glib and oversimplistic response. Like, we just explained how Iraq is involved in all of this and how the Saudis are involved in all of this, and the Saudis are not terrorists. At least the Saudi government did not condone or endorse these attacks, no matter what they were, whether it was the attacks on the USS Cole, which we'll get to in a minute, or the attacks on U.S. embassies in Africa, which we're about to get to right now, or obviously 9/11. Like, Saudis completely disowned 9/11, and then just recently, within the past few years, the U.S. government allowed U.S. citizens to sue the government of Saudi Arabia for any involvement, and there was very little suits brought against the Saudi government because they just weren't that involved. It's a common misperception. And you're not going to find me to defend Saudi Arabia very much. Not like the greatest country on earth by far, but they certainly weren't that involved in 9/11. They weren't harboring our enemy, and they weren't condoning the attacks at all. September 1994, Mohammed Omar founds the Taliban in Kandahar. That's in Afghanistan. December 24th, 1994, Christmas Eve, armed Islamic group of Algeria militants attempt to crash Air France flight 8969 into the Eiffel Tower, influencing Al-Qaeda's future planning. So they're trying, yeah, I mean, and France is like, a lot of Americans like to give France a lot of crap for, you know, being surrender monkeys during World War II, but really, the French love freedom and liberty as much as Americans do. For sure. And they see people being oppressed, they want to get involved and get dirty just like we do. Not to the extent that we do. I mean, it's like 50 French troops for every 200 American troops, right? But French are a strong ally, and that's got to be remembered. They were America's oldest ally. January 6th, 1995, Operation Bojinka is discovered by Manila police on a laptop computer in an apartment after a fire. So Bojinka was a word that Al-Qaeda members would just say. It's a made-up word. But Operation Bojinka was the kind of the predecessor to the 9/11 plot. Operation Bojinka was, we're going to take all of these planes, we're going to hijack them over the Atlantic Ocean, and we're going to go all over the world. We're going to attack the Eiffel Tower. We're going to attack the World Trade Center. We're going to attack San Francisco. We're going to attack other places in Europe, Germany, whatever. Because if they're over the Atlantic, they can spread out and just destroy whatever they want to. That was Operation Bojinka, and it gets foiled by Manila police in 1995. In February 95, a month later, Ramzi Youssef is arrested in Pakistan. Now, this is the guy that perpetrated the World Trade Center bombings in 1993. He's finally arrested in Pakistan and is discovered to have financial links to Bin Laden. Because Bin Laden's bankrolling all this. He's still a multi-millionaire. In June 95, U.S. intelligence links Al-Qaeda to an unsuccessful assassination attempt against Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. So Hosni Mubarak was the president after Anwar Sadat. And he, president, I say in kind of quotes, he was president from, I think, 81 to 2011. So,
holy crap.
You can call that a president if you're president for 30 years. I don't really think that counts. U.S. intelligence links Al-Qaeda to an unsuccessful assassination attempt against Hosni Mubarak. So now Al-Qaeda is definitely on our radar. We are watching them. We've known about Osama bin Laden for a long time. He wasn't really perceived as a threat. We knew about him in the late 80s for sure, but he was just like this guy like fighting for Afghanis, and he owned this, he was a really, really rich guy. He was a player, right? But we didn't really think much of him at the time. But now mid-90s, we're like, okay, well, this guy's bankrolling bad dudes that are against U.S. interests. So we need to keep a really close eye on this guy. January 8th, 1986, bin Laden makes bellicose statements regarding the United States and Saudi Arabia, Michael Schur creates a CIA unit, the Bin Laden Issue Station, to gather intelligence on bin Laden. Like I said, they are starting to take this guy a lot more seriously now. And May 18th, 1996, bin Laden moves back to Afghanistan because he's not really welcome anywhere else. He gets kicked out of Sudan, which is, you know, you've got to really be an asshole to get kicked out of Sudan. He's not welcome in Saudi Arabia at all. There's one point where, so bin Laden's son, Omar bin Laden, writes a book that's like a tell-all. Because Omar is like following his dad around the globe at this point. And he writes a book that's basically a tell-all of what the bin Ladens were going through as a family, and like as a, what Osama bin Laden was going through as a man during all of this time. And at one point, they're flying from Sudan over Saudi Arabia airspace to get to Pakistan, because that's how you have to go. And he turns to his son and says something like, the Saudis don't know that we're flying over their airspace. If they don't know, we will live. If they know, they will surely like shoot us down. Something to those lines. And there's a really... I can't remember the exact details, but I think they're in Iran. They have to make a refueling stop in Iran on the way to Pakistan. And the Iranian Revolutionary Guard is there, and they want to search the plane because they're like, who's on this aircraft? Remember, bin Laden's not welcome anywhere, even in Iran. And if they find him, they're either going to kill him or put him in prison forever.
He's like in a hiding stage now then.
Yeah. Yeah. And bin Laden is obviously a very smart guy and very good at hiding. And he, his son, and his right-hand man at the time, I can't remember the names of the details, but they're all in the plane holding AKs facing the door, like ready in case the Iranian Revolutionary Guard wants to search the plane. They're just going to mow them down and take off and get the hell out of there with whatever fuel they've got and just get the heck out of there. Which, I mean, Iran's got jets. Like, I don't know what their whole plan was. They can come after you pretty easily. They don't search the plane. They're like, the flight crew is essentially like, we don't even want to get off the plane. We just want to refuel and bounce. And so the Iranian Revolutionary Guard is like, fine, refuel. We didn't see you. Get the heck out of our country. They barely make it back to Afghanistan. Now, this is the mid-90s, so he only gets more and more hated around the world. So in June, so that was in May of 96, in June 25th, 1996, Al-Qaeda commits the Khobar Towers bombing targeting American servicemen in Saudi Arabia to participate in Operation Southern Watch. I actually don't know too much about that bombing. I don't think it killed too many Americans, but moving on. August 23rd, 96, bin Laden issues a fatwa declaring war on the United States, which is, a fatwa is a religious... it's a call for religious war, which he can't do. He can't issue a fatwa technically because he's not a religious leader. He's more of a political leader, a military leader, if anything. So technically in Sharia law, he can't really declare a fatwa, but he issues one anyway because he's whatever. declaring war on the United States, which is published in the Arabic language newspaper Al-Quds Al-Arabi in London. The FBI and the U.S. Attorney for Southern District of New York open a criminal file on him under the charge of seditious conspiracy. September 27, 1996, the Taliban, a radical Islamic movement, rises to power by conquering Kabul and declares the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. That sounds familiar. November 96, informant Jamal El-Fadl first reveals the existence of Al-Qaeda to the FBI. So they didn't know Al-Qaeda existed for a few years. November 23, 1996, attackers hijack Ethiopian Airlines Flight 961 and most of the passengers die in the resulting crash landing. So who knows where they were going with Ethiopian Airlines, and that's obviously very, very far eastern Africa. So they, if it was a fully loaded plane, they could have been going to Jerusalem. They could have been going to Riyadh to attack Saudi Arabia. They could have been going to France. I mean, you can really get to anywhere from that part of the world, not America, though. In February 98, bin Laden expands religious edict against U.S. and allies by issuing a second fatwa calling on Muslims to join a jihad against Jews and Christians until the United States and Israel evacuate the Middle East, and reiterates the themes in a televised interview with ABC News. This is February 98. Also in 98, 9/11.
I don't see how, like, ABC News agrees to something like that, you know?
Why?
I don't know, like, why would they want his message heard, you know?
It's news.
I guess. I mean,
news is news, whether it's good or evil, and people need to make up their minds. People need to be aware of this.
Yeah, guy. I guess I'm used to thinking about how it is now. So, like, news now.
Oh, yeah,
no. They would pick and choose, you know, and I don't know if, like, no one would be able to get a message like this out now.
Mm-hmm.
Unless it helped out Biden or helped out someone that they want.
Now you're only going to find the stuff on, like, WikiLeaks or maybe Vice, but even Vice is kind of just gone off.
Yeah, Vice is shaky. It's just crazy how that's changed. And that's 98?
98.
Yeah.
February of 98, early 98. Dang, dude. So also in 98, 9/11 hijacker Mohammed Atta and associates are monitored by some U.S. and Germany. In their Hamburg residence. So Mohammed Atta, one of the lead hijackers in 9/11, has been under surveillance since 1998. So we knew about bin Laden, we knew about Mohammed Atta, we knew about the fatwas and declarations of war against the United States. On June 8, 1998, a U.S. grand jury delivers a sealed indictment of bin Laden for conspiracy to attack defense utilities in the United States. So this is where it gets real heavy. On August 7th, 1998, the 1998 U.S. embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania are carried out by Al-Qaeda. They bomb our embassy in Kenya, and they bomb our embassy in Tanzania on the same day. They blow up both buildings, and lots of Americans die on each. Let's see real quick. More than 200 people were killed in nearly simultaneous truck bomb explosions in the two East African cities of Dar es Salaam in Tanzania and Nairobi, Kenya. And these buildings are, like, totally destroyed. Big truck bombs. Think, like, Oklahoma City style. They used TNT, ammonium nitrate, bombs. Let's see. It doesn't say how many Americans were killed, I don't think. Anyway.
That's a good precursor to us, you know?
Yep. So that's in August 7th, 1998, U.S. Embassy bombings. So we've got the Battle of Mogadishu that we lost and Black Hawk Down 1993. And then we've got these embassy bombings in 98. And, you know, a couple little things happen in between, but those are the two major eye-openers. Like, Al-Qaeda's serious. We got to start taking these guys a little more seriously, especially after they killed dozens of Americans in Africa. August 8th through 10th, 1998, Mazar-e-Sharif, the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda's 055 Brigade massacre between 4,000 to 8,000 people, including 11 Iranian diplomats. Iran threatened to intervene but relented after mediation by the United Nations. On August 20th, 1998, Operation Infinite Reach, a U.S. U.S. cruise missiles strike on Al-Qaeda training camp in Khost, Afghanistan, retaliation of Al-Qaeda's U.S. embassy bombings 2 weeks earlier. So instead of putting any boots on the ground, like Mogadishu, Bill Clinton is like, let's just friggin' cruise missile these guys. Probably a better idea. Also in 1998, an embassy bombing suspect claims extensive network of Al-Qaeda sleeper agents is planning a big attack inside U.S. The 9/11 hijackers are already in the U.S. at this point. And embassy bombing suspect claims extensive, quote, extensive network of Al-Qaeda sleeper agents, end quote, is planning a, quote, big attack, end quote, inside the United States. That's the first hint of 9/11. October 8th, 1999, 2 years before September 11th, Al-Qaeda is designated as a foreign terrorist organization by the U.S. State Department. October 15, 1999, the UN Security Council passes a resolution demanding that the Taliban extradite bin Laden. Of course, they're not going to do that. October 31, 1999, suicide pilot crashes Egypt Air Flight 990 into the ocean, killing hundreds of people on board. November to December 99, the 2000 Millennium attack plots for the bombings in Jordan and Los Angeles International Airport are discovered and prevented. December of 99, Indian Airlines Flight 814 is hijacked. So they are starting to hijack more and more planes. December 99, Indian Flight 814 is hijacked. One passenger dies while the others are released. October 12th, 2000. I believe it's an Aegis missile cruiser, the USS Cole, I think it's a frigate, is going to refuel in that port of Aden in Yemen that I mentioned. And a trash barge comes up, and there's two guys on this trash barge, and they say, hey, throw us your trash. The ship, you know, throws them the trash. Usually it takes two loads, this trash barge. These guys go off and away and unload the barge. Another barge comes up, trash barge. Like, okay, routine. Comes up. Instead of asking for trash, they detonate a giant bomb and blow a hole the size of a house on the side of the USS Cole, killing, I think, 11 or 14 U.S. military members, nearly sinking the ship. And this is a fairly new ship, probably less than 10 years old at the time. And I think the USS Cole is actually, it might still be in commission, or it's either still in commission and still floating around the world, or it's just got decommissioned recently after like 30 years of service. But it was bombed in Yemen by Al-Qaeda. That was, you know, the third really direct big attack on the U.S. from Al-Qaeda, and it was the first attack on U.S. service members by Al-Qaeda, U.S. military. So that was for sure an act of war, right? August 6th, 2001, 1 month before September 11th, President George W. Bush receives the President's Daily Brief. Bin Laden determined to strike in U.S., warning of an imminent attack on the United States by Al-Qaeda. So we knew something was going to happen, but we didn't know what exactly they were planning. We knew it was probably going to be a hijacking. We didn't know when. We didn't know where. And we've got thousands of flights a day happening all around the world. So, kind of hard to pinpoint that. Especially when there's only, you know, 50 people globally that know about this attack. That have planned it. And only 19 hijackers. It's a lot harder to... Let's just say the NSA was not what it was now, right? There was no... monitoring every email. There was no monitoring every phone call, every text. It was like they were emailing back and forth. Al-Qaeda was. That's how they communicated mostly, through email. But basically impossible to monitor, right? There's millions of Americans emailing at the time.
Yeah, the unfortunate thing is that it took, you know, the Patriot Act for us, for that to happen. So it's like a, like, kind of sucks, you know?
Yeah.
It's like all these freedoms are gone, but now they can monitor email.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is, like, you know? I think, man, maybe the question, the Facebook Warrior question next week should be, did Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden succeed in their objective?
To not, to, like, get rid of freedom in America?
Well, the main objective was to get America out of the Middle East from occupation. And then their secondary objective was to make America less free.
Yeah. Right. And I saw that today, and I was like, yeah, they did.
Yeah. They definitely
succeeded, man.
I mean, Osama bin Laden is dead, but Al-Qaeda still lives, and the Taliban is back, and we are not there. And we are way less free than we were 20 years ago. And I don't think people feel any safer. I don't think they feel any safer. September 9th, 2001. Al-Qaeda assassinates Ahmad Shah Massoud, commander of the Northern Alliance in the Afghan Civil War. That happened from 96 to 2001. Once we invade Afghanistan in October of 2001, I'm missing some sort of event that happened in between. Oh yeah, 9/11. After we invade Afghanistan, we basically quash the Taliban within a matter of months. And there is no more civil war. And then we just kind of sit around for 20 years.
Yeah, we didn't do anything.
I wouldn't say we sat around for 20 years.
Not do anything, but like we finished our objective pretty quick.
4,500 troops lost on America's side in Afghanistan over 20 years. Pretty good stats when we, you know, killed tens and tens of thousands of Mujahideen and Taliban and anyone who is against the Afghan status quo, which is, it's so tribal over there. There's so many different sects. It's pretty much anybody that goes against the main narrative. And yeah,
that's what we're dealing with now, dude.
That's what we're dealing with now.
And anyone that goes against the main narrative, you know?
Mm-hmm. So that's a basic timeline. Golly. Here's a really brief timeline of the planning of 9/11. 92, Muhammad Atta arrives in Germany. 94, planning Operation Bojinka begins in the Philippines. Like, yeah, okay, like I said, the Al-Qaeda is in the Philippines at this time, too. And I was like, they are kind of all over the place. There's a lot of Muslims in the Philippines, too. 95, Operation Bojinka is foiled. All right, 96, Marwan el-Shehhi and Ziad Jarrah arrive in Germany. I think these are other hijackers. More arrive in Germany. Recruitment of terrorists in Germany starts. In 98, Bill Clinton is warned, Bin Laden preparing to hijack U.S. aircraft inside U.S. 1998, Bin Laden is warned. In 99, the Hamburg cell is fully formed. Also in 99, Germany monitors to call 9/11 hijacker al-Shehhi, shares information with CIA. Germans monitor call mentioning key al-Qaeda Hamburg cell members, including 9/11 hijacker Atta's full name and number. 9/11 hijacker Jarrah has unofficial wedding photograph, later suggests German intelligence has informant. And again later that year, three 9/11 hijackers obtain U.S. visas somehow. In 1999, Hani Hanjour obtains pilot's license despite having dubious skills. And a lot of these hijackers, they learned how to fly either in Germany or in America, in Arizona, I think. One of them learned how to fly. It was one of those southwestern states. And they learned to fly Cessnas and other small aircraft. And they go from that to a 767. So that's where a lot of people are like, nah, how did they learn how to fly such a large aircraft? You know, that's not what they were trained on.
Yeah, I know, but I thought they have pilots right there. They didn't kill the pilots, did they?
Yeah, they did.
Oh.
And they flew the planes. It's not like they held a box cutter of the pilots.
I don't know, dude. Maybe there's a half autopilot on these things automatically or something.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
No, you'd have to enter in coordinates and that sort of thing. They didn't know how to operate the autopilot. All they knew how to do was throttle, check your altitude, use the yoke, real basic stuff. I mean, real basic stuff. That's what they knew how to do. So,
wow.
Yeah. So.
Well, then it makes sense that all of this stuff leads up to 9/11 then. Like, it's not, you know, that right there just explains how their tensions just progressed and progressed and progressed. Mm-hmm. And
I was going to say, like,
it's pretty clear that's what happened.
Exactly. That's the main point I want to bring home to listeners is that 9/11 didn't happen in a vacuum. It didn't happen out of nowhere. Like, we did stuff to piss off these guys. And whether I'm not saying it was justified by any means, obviously. But you have to know where they were coming from, their mentality, their history. Like, know thy enemy.
Yeah, and it takes, you know, 10 years or so to even do something like that. Like, to progress like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, think of America now. It's taken 20 years for us, you know, to build up to where we're at. You know what I mean? As far as being as tense as we are right now. Something's going to happen in America. I just don't know what. We don't know what yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm saying that it takes a long buildup. Mm-hmm. Everything like that takes a long buildup, yeah. You know? So.
The stuff we didn't get into today, we can kind of just touch on, I feel like. Because, I mean, I'm of the opinion that the main narrative of 9/11 is the truth, right? There is no conspiracy. There's no government knew in advance exactly what was going to happen, and they collapsed Building 7. I had a lot of doubts about Building 7. Which, for those who don't know, let me just catch you up real quick. So there's 7 buildings in the World Trade Center. There's the 2 towers, that's building 1 and 2. Then there's 3, 4, 5, 6 smaller buildings that surround the towers. All of those got destroyed during the 2 planes hit the 2 big towers. Those collapsed and destroyed the other buildings around it. Building 7, which is had a lot of federal agencies in it, like the CIA, the FBI, the DEA, were all inside Building 7. They all had offices inside Building 7. Again, Sheldon Silverstein owned this building as well. Around mid-late afternoon, so the building collapsed at around 5 p.m., 5:20 p.m., and around 4:30, 5 o'clock, firefighters called Silverstein, chief firefighter of New York, called Shel Silverstein and said, hey, look, I don't think we're going to be able to control this fire. It's burning nonstop. And, you know, and Shel Silverstein says, quote, pull it. Now, a lot of people theorize that what he meant was demolish the building. Like, now's the time. Go ahead and knock it down. Of course, there's no implosive materials inside the building to just do that. But that was kind of the conspiracy theory, right? Now, what he meant was, Shelvestine meant by saying pull it was pull all of the firefighters out, because we just lost dozens in the collapse of the World Trade Center buildings, you know, towers 1 and 2. So we don't want to lose any more. Pull it, let the building go, let it burn to the ground. You know, it's not worth the lives of those firefighters at this point, especially at this point. So, Building 7 raged all day with this intense, intense fire. And, like I said, at 5:20 p.m., it collapses. And it's like, you know, the Twin Towers collapse an hour and a half after the planes hit. And then you see this, and this is like 10:30 in the morning. And then this other building kind of randomly collapses at 5:20. That's weird. It's really weird. And, of course, it's on video. And when you watch the video of the building collapse, you realize that this building falls at the rate of gravity. I mean, this building goes done. It's not like, you know,
I mean, that's how
it's not incremental.
Yeah, the Twin Towers look like that too, though.
Yeah.
Because they're made to do that, apparently. I don't know. That's what I hear that. I hear that people say that. Like when it collapses, it's supposed to implode because it does. They don't want to cause any other damage anywhere else. Mm-hmm. But I don't know.
And then, so the fires that were burning from Building 7, after once they burn all day, they just get hotter and hotter, and they do get hot enough to melt support structures inside the building. Now, I've also heard the conspiracy theory of, well, they were renovating the building and doing all these upgrades at the time, which is also true. They were just repainting it like the day before, all the interior walls. And I'm like, okay. Now, that fire in Building 7, which I still have a little bit of doubts about Building 7 and a little bit like, because I have no doubt in my mind that the government knew that the World Trade Centers in New York City were a target of Al-Qaeda terrorists. They didn't know exactly when or how. They had an idea that it was probably going to be a hijacked plane and they were probably going to go attack the World Trade Centers because they had done it before. Al-Qaeda in 1993 attacked the World Trade, well, not Al-Qaeda, but similar terrorists, very, very similar, basically pre-Al-Qaeda. And they knew it was on their radar. And the government knew that the World Trade Center in New York was on Al-Qaeda's radar. Same with the World Trade Center in San Francisco and probably Dallas and other places. And so there's a theory that instead of just paint, they're painting on the inside of the walls in WTC-7. Yeah, it was paint mixed with thermite. And that's what caused the fires to burn so hot enough to basically incinerate the entire inside of the building. Now, thermite, if you don't know what thermite is, it's this material. It's aluminum shavings and iron oxide. That's all it is. It's like rust and aluminum. And you mix them together. And you light it with magnesium spark, and it will burn through an engine block. It will melt anything in its path. And it's hot stuff. So if you light that on fire with the right kind of temperature spark, then it will take down a building, no problem. So there's those theories that it was renovated. There was also these theories that Building 7 had bombs already inside of it, placed inside for a controlled demolition at the right time for minimal casualties. Now, why did they want to destroy this building? Well, because the CIA had offices in it, the FBI had offices in it. There were sensitive materials in it that maybe they didn't want ever discovered.
It wouldn't surprise me if they already had this stuff in there. Mm-hmm. Like, anyway, not because of a terrorist attack or anything. They just have it there literally as a safety because it's intelligence agencies.
Yep.
Like it's pretty obvious.
That's a really good point.
You can't like, it's like having the pill, you know, whenever you take it, you die.
Yeah, it's like having, like if you're a spy, having the cyanide capsule.
They would do that. That's like a no-brainer to me. They would have some kind of weird thing that like they can just demolish it real quick.
So this is a kind of a way beside the point, but it's a similar tactic that Switzerland, the country in Europe, is surrounded by mountains, right? And surrounded by rivers as well. Now there's all these bridges and entry points into the country. Currently, all of the entry and exit points into and around Switzerland are rigged to blow. So if they're ever invaded, boom, they press one button, all of their bridges blow up, you can't get in or out of Switzerland. It's a contingency plan, right?
Yeah. Like
backup, backup, backup.
Right.
Destroying WTC-7 could have been their contingency plan. Could have been their backup,
right,
backup.
Right.
So that's a really good point. Yeah. I'm not excluding that at all because very few people died. I think maybe one guy was still left in WTC-7 when it went down.
Really?
And he may have been dead before it went down.
Yeah, like you can't. Yeah.
Which is a whole other conspiracy in itself.
Yeah, like why was he left there for dead?
I can't remember. I should have done more on this, but it was a guy that knew too much, supposedly, and he was left inside the building, and he either was shot or poisoned or something like that, and he was in the building when it collapsed, and That was it. There's also those theories of people seeing explosions out of the towers as it collapsed. And that's just the pressure. So what happened during the collapse of the towers was the inside of the towers collapsed first, right? The interior of the building collapsed. The floors started popping down. And then the exterior, which was, according to the architecture of the building, that's what was holding the building up, is the exterior frame. That's how it was designed, not the interior. Like most buildings have columns. The exterior frame was holding up the World Trade Center towers. And so naturally, the inside, it hollows out from the inside. And you see these kind of like ejections of dust and a little bit of fire kind of pop out from below where the building is collapsing. You're like, that looks like explosions from a controlled demolition. That's exactly what it looks like. Admittedly, that is what it looks like, but that's not what it was. Because if you have, think about pancakes falling on top of each other, the air in between the pancakes gets pushed out, path of least resistance, which is the windows. They bust out these windows. That's what causes that, you know, that little puff of explosion, quote unquote. So the insides of the buildings collapse first, then the outside, and then the whole top kind of falls on top of the rest of the building itself. That's why you see those. It's not a controlled demolition. There were no other explosives found, no other explosive materials found, just a whole bunch of burnt jet fuel. That's basically what did it in. And there's been models after models, scientific models, explaining exactly what happened. I've seen, there was one computer-generated model that showed like every little fragment of the airplane like hitting each little pillar and how exactly it went down. Now, of course, it's a kind of conjecture, but it seems fairly accurate and extremely plausible that that's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
And then for the Pentagon, this is what really pisses me off when people go, well, there was no plane that hit the Pentagon. It was a missile. But that's stupid. You've done no research. Okay, there's photographic evidence of a plane hitting the Pentagon. There's also knocked over street lamps from where the wings had hit the street lamp. You know, a few hundred yards away from the Pentagon, a missile's not going to knock over street lamps. They found, and you say the hole is too small for a plane. And first of all, it's not. There's little space. There's spaces where the wings were. And one of the wings was knocked off before it hit the Pentagon. Not a lot of people know that. So, yeah, the hole is going to be slightly smaller than the wingspan of the plane because one of the wings was knocked completely off right before it hit the building by a, I want to say like a billboard or something like that. And then they also say that there's a hole, I think it's like a 8-foot hole, towards the front of the impact zone, or towards the back of the impact zone, where the nose of the aircraft supposedly would have been. And say, well, 8 feet, that's way too small for a 747, 747, 757's nose. You know, that's way too small. So it had to have been a missile. Well, they actually found the landing gear, the front landing gear. That's what made that hole. They found that deeper inside. Because the front landing gear had flown off and made this hole, and that's how that came about. And then they say, well, where are the airplane fragments? Look around. They're everywhere. If you look at photographic evidence from the Pentagon on September 11, 2001, timestamp photos from the FBI, from even just amateur photographers that were there that day, you can see American Airlines chunks of plane, the whole silver fuselage with the red and blue stripes on it. Plain as day, right there for everyone to see. And there's lots of other like YouTube videos you can look at that show models of exactly how the plane flew in, like almost like flight simulator style. So I don't buy the whole it was a missile thing or it was an inside job. It doesn't seem even remotely plausible to me now. And I believe that at one point, it was all planned out by the government. I thought that was just another reason for us to go to war in the Middle East. And, you know,
the fact is we don't need another reason. Like, we don't have to create a reason.
Yeah,
the Middle
exactly.
East is literally always in constant freaking battle with each other.
Yep.
One way or another, mm-hmm. and it just turns out it's probably one of our allies over there. So we're like, oh, we can go to war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it's pretty easy. Saudi, you need help? Got you. You know, like it just
yeah
stuff like that is always happening.
There's always a reason to go to war somewhere.
Soleimani, like we had that happen. That was Middle East. Like you're just like it's constant, dude.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know about somewhere or everywhere. I mean, like literally, the Middle East is so bad about that.
And if we really wanted oil that bad, why wouldn't we just go after Venezuela? It's closer, easier to control. It's in our hemisphere. They're blatant socialists. Why wouldn't we just be like, you know what, Truman Doctrine? We're not going to allow socialism, communism to spread in our hemisphere. Let's go invade Venezuela. We'd have the support of Colombia. We'd have the support of probably Brazil, other surrounding countries next to Venezuela. Super easy. Why don't we do it?
Yeah. Yeah, you mean yeah?
No, I'm just saying, like, if we wanted their oil, yeah. Like they have the most oil reserves in the world, more than Saudis do.
Yeah.
I mean, and guess where they're shipping all their oil? They're shipping it to Russia, some to Russia, and a lot to North Korea, and a lot to Cuba, and that's against our interests. Why don't we go to war in Venezuela? It makes way more sense than going to war in the Middle East.
It does. Yeah. I mean.
And then
I don't necessarily want to go to war right now, but
I don't either. I don't think it's a good idea. But I'm just saying, like, if to conspiracy theorists, they say like, oh, we just went and invaded Iraq
right.
just
no,
to get their
of,
oil.
There's a lot of better things we could do with that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And then after we invented fracking, it's like we don't need them at all anymore. We're energy independent now.
I mean, I could see how Venezuela would cause other problems. You know, North Korea would be after us.
Mm-hmm.
Russia would be after us, but
I mean North Korea is they don't
Iran Iraq
they have no like means they don't, Saudi they have no means to attack us. North Korea might have some halfway decent cyber attacks against us, but China's way worse when it comes to cyber attacks. And then there's Russia, which is the worst of them all when it comes to cyber attacks. And hopefully we can get somebody on real soon to talk about cybersecurity versus Russia and China, because I know someone that is in communications with the upper echelons of U.S. government in regards to defending ourselves against China and Russia. And he basically says that if we don't straight up bomb the effing crap out of China, they're just going to keep doing it.
Yes.
And I don't mean like bomb, you know, target like cruise missile, their military installations. I mean like freaking A-bomb Shanghai.
Yeah.
Like, kill lots and lots of Chinese people. They're not gonna blink an eye if they lose one or two, you know, little military bases in the South China Sea.
Right.
They're not gonna hesitate.
Well, they kill their own people all the time. Yeah,
they kill Uyghurs.
Not even just that, like I found out when they do space stuff, all their debris they just let it fall. And literally it will hit people, like kill people.
Yeah, they don't care. They've got a billion and a half people.
You're talking about like radiated or not radiated, but like it has some kind of weird stuff on it, like NST or some crap that's like toxic to you. It's like they just let it fall. It's like red stuff. I don't know. Anyway, I was hearing about all this crap because I was listening to like another guy that used to be an astronaut. You know, he works for SpaceX now.
Oh, whoa.
Pretty cool guy.
Get him on the podcast. What are we doing?
It was an old Joe Rogan episode.
Oh.
So he's already famous, dude. But I might have Arbitrage Andy on. That guy's awesome.
Cool.
He's a big-time guy in the stock market. Has like a huge Instagram account. He just started a newsletter and got really political.
Huh.
And so I read his newsletter and I was like, dude, you need to come on the show. And he literally replied. I was like, whoa. He said, we might be able to make that happen. I'm like, oh, cool, man. Dude. That'd be sick. Anyway, we'll see what happens. I was like, that'd be little titty, man. That's what I said. Anyway, he's a... Yeah, anyway, funny guy. Wow, that was a deep dive and a half.
It sure was, Scott.
Cool. Well, I'm going to do some editing on that one, and probably preface the whole thing, every whole episode, tell people, hey, this is a deep dive.
Yeah.
Guys, be prepared. And I might timestamp it. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. If you just want to hear about the background, here's the way to go. If you just want to hear about the conspiracy theory part, here's where to go.
Yeah.
And we could do a whole other episode just on the conspiracy side, because we've just touched on a couple of them. I didn't really do a lot of research into the conspiracy sides because
I just think we're
believe
I don't
as
know.
Much.
Yeah, I don't know about right now in that kind of conspiracy because it's already happened. If it was a conspiracy and it did actually all this stuff went crazy, mm-hmm. it's already happened. Right now, we're dealing with other things that could potentially be real that are being called conspiracy theories.
Mm.
You know, Wuhan lab leaking this COVID virus that we actually helped create. You know, that's a conspiracy theory, but it's like. Seems pretty legitimate to me from what I'm looking at right
seems
now.
Seems like it's just proven.
You know,
that Anthony Fauci
lied. We did gain a function research.
Perjured
you know,
himself.
My point in all that is saying that the conspiracy theories that we're being told about right now, that's what I want to worry about.
Yep.
Because that's stuff that's going to end up in us freaking being like fighting back.
Yeah. I mean, the vaccine mandate that Biden just passed is
it's
us.
Not going to fly, dude.
It's us fighting back. It's not going to fly.
There's no way, dude. Like, even he's like, come after it or go at it or whatever he said to all the Republican governors, you know? Like, they are going to do that, Joe, and they are going to win. Like, we're not going to stand for this.
Yeah.
What are you going to have, 34 states against your freaking California and New York? Like, this is where it would be like, okay, yeah, we're standing against it, so screw off, you know? Yeah. As soon as he did that, everyone was freaking out, and I'm like, it's not even going to, nothing's going to happen.
Yeah.
No one's going to let that fly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no employer. And the Daily Wire came out, they have over 100 employees, and they said, hey, we're not going to enforce this. We've already talked to our team of lawyers, and...
Yeah, you don't have to, that's the other thing people don't understand is that it has to be enforced.
Yeah.
A law or a mandate has to be enforced, right? Who's going to do that?
Yeah.
The cops that pay attention to orders and only do that? Yeah, maybe
the labor
then.
Department, OSHA.
Maybe OSHA, yeah.
But what are they going to do? Send health inspectors out to every single business that's got more than 100 people and go, who's vaccinated? Who's
yeah,
not?
Then
where's your
say,
list?
Here's your fine, and you're going to say, cool, and you're not going to pay it, and then find out what happens.
Yeah. Well, then they'll stick the IRS on you.
Yeah.
Will not get vaccinated because the government tells me to.
Same.
Now, there's a whole other situation where, when we were talking about this earlier, my grandma is 91 and she doesn't want people over unless they've been vaccinated. So I might get vaccinated for that reason, just because I want to see her. But the whole fact that she's so afraid to like, she goes to church and leaves the house occasionally, but for the most part, she's just in her house, which is, I'm glad she's got a nice house with a garden and stuff that she can keep herself occupied and still be a little bit mobile and, you know, go outside and that sort of stuff. But it's like they're making people live in complete fear of even their own family. And that's
they're creating hypochondriacs.
Yeah. On a massive scale. And then you know what that does? You know what that does? I need the government to come help me and save me.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Yes.
Tell me what to do. Govern me harder.
Govern me harder, daddy. Yeah. Yeah, I know. You're right. You're right. I failed the other day because I let a police officer search my car.
Oh, you did?
And I shouldn't have.
Why? Why did he pull you over?
Speeding.
You were just, he was just like, can I search your car? And you're like, sure.
No, I said no. And he was like, why not? You're hiding something? I was like, well, no, it's a matter of, don't you have to have a warrant or something? He was like, well, okay, but why don't you? And he just like kept going and going and going. And I'm an idiot. Like, this is where I'm saying I failed because I'm like, so I need to be better, you know? Because like, if I break down to some stupid cop that can't even talk right, he was like missing teeth and stuff. If I break down to that guy, his name was Peyton, then what's going to happen when they come up to me and they want my guns? Like, I gotta be ready, you know? Mm-hmm. So I was like, damn, what do I do, you know? And he had a backup guy on the other side, you know?
Mm.
And I'm like...
Do you, like, roll down
like,
all your
well,
windows when
you
get pulled
oh,
over?
Yeah. No, I already had all my windows rolled down because, like, I have a 4Runner, so,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's that Jeep life type stuff, you know? But I'm like, no. Nah. He's like, well, what's going on here? I'm like, yeah, it's a matter of, like, freedom and liberty, dude. I don't know. That's what I said. It's the exact words I said. I was like, I don't know, dude. It's a matter of freedom and liberty. You know, whatever. It doesn't matter mm-hmm. because, like, you should just be allowed to search my car. He's like, well... I'm looking for your consent, but are you trying to hide something? You know, he kept doing that, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the reason I let it go is because I was like, I don't have anything in my car. And he's like, I'm not going to plant anything in your stupid car. Like, don't worry about that. I'm just literally looking around real quick, and that's it. That's what he said. He finally said that. And I was like, what the hell? It's so weird.
Why would you? I would
immediately assume that?
Why would you say that?
Yeah. Why would you say that?
Easy, Mark Furman.
No. But then I thought, I was like, if I say, keep saying no and resist, mm-hmm. next thing you know, they call a dog out, and the dog smells something. And I'm effed, right? Dude, but I don't have anything in the car. I didn't have anything in the car, but it was just like they can do that. You know, they can make the dog.
The thing is, like, I've seen dogs that go, like, oh, the dog sits down. That means he hit on your car. Or the dog licked in the air. That means he hit on your car.
Yeah.
Oh, the dog looked at me funny. The dog took it on the side of the road. Means you got some contraband in your car. I'm going to search it now. They'll find any behavior the dog can be excused as a hit.
Yes, I know.
Or he signaled or whatever.
So I knew no matter what. Yes. I knew no matter what, I'd probably be in the same situation.
Although I will say.
So I was wasting time and I was like, whatever, dude. He's like, all right. I was like, fine, search my car. I was like, fine. He's like, okay, yeah, just be a minute. It takes like 10 minutes back there. It comes out. Okay, get out of the car. Okay, fine. I stood in the back of my car. Like, I stood behind my car just waiting. Mm-hmm. He just looks in my center glove compartment and then looks in my. Or center console and looks at my glove compartment. That was it. And I was like, it was dumb. This chode over here was trying to distract me. And I'm like, no. I'm watching him.
Yeah,
he was like, well, we're just doing our job. I was like, no. I'm just watching him.
I would just say, shut up.
We're just doing our job.
I respect like, what cops. Happens? Just shut up. Like, you're wasting my time, bro.
When he said that, I was like, crap. You know, like the Back to Blue movement, I'm over it, dude. I've never had good luck with cops ever.
Here's the deal.
And they said, we're just doing our job. That's what it's going to be every time. Yeah, we're just doing our job.
That's tyranny, okay?
We're going to arrest you because you don't have vaccines. We're just doing our job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh, you're not wearing a mask in public. I'm going to fine you. Here's a ticket. We're just doing our job.
Just get on the train. Go down the tracks. Welcome to your new home. You know?
Yeah, and but I know. And I think that people think it's crazy to think that far ahead with this type of stuff. But I'm like, if he did it with searching my vehicle for no freaking reason at all.
Mm-hmm.
Just to be honest, I'm a white dude driving a freaking 2016 4Runner. It doesn't look like anything like someone that would carry anything in their car in the mm-hmm. first place. So I'm like, what's going on here? You know what I mean?
Where was this?
This was Lake Palestine, dude. Small town.
Okay. They're just
small
bored.
Town, Lakeside. They're probably just bored. I know. It's Coffee City. They have, 500 people in their fucking town? I don't know, dude. I'm just saying, like, what the hell was that, you know? And then...
That's when you just... I mean, if you have the time... Man, that pisses me off. If you have the time to say, oh, you can call a dog, but you can't detain me on the side of the road while we wait for a canine unit to become available. Can't do that.
Can't?
Mm-mm. Not without probable cause. They can detain you if the canine unit's on the way, but if they have to wait for one, then they have to let you go. They can't detain you for 2 hours or whatever on the side of the road. That's unsafe. I've been there. I've had that happen to me.
See, that's what I'm saying. I need these, like, I need to be prepared so I can be like, nah, dude, you can't do that crap.
Me and my buddy were leaving College Station to go to my farm just to, but he'd never been. I wanted to show him, you know, the farm. And we got pulled over, and it was two college kids in a red Camaro. So, of course, we're going to get pulled over. And the cop is like, well, you only need to step out of the car. And I'm like, I'll step out. And then my friend who knows the Constitution, the cop is like, you need to step out of the car. He goes, no. He's like, okay, well, you need to show me your driver's license. He goes, no. What's your name? I'm not going to tell you. Well, I could just pull it up. How are you going to do that if you don't have any information on me? Well, are you just going to be just a jerk this whole time? My friend's like, yeah, I'm not going to tell you anything about me. You have any right to know that. I'm the passenger. I'm a passenger in this vehicle. I'm being transported. That's all you need to know. He never ended up showing her ID, nothing. And this, of course, sets her off. And she's like, well, I'm gonna call a canine unit, and we're gonna search your whole car. And I'm like, okay. And she's like, okay. And she goes back to her cruiser and is all pissed off and huffy, and she's a frumpy, freaking stupid cop. And I'm like... Like, all right. And then she comes back all just even angrier, just like, there's no canine units available. I guess I'm just going to have to let y'all go. And I'm like, all right, see ya. Psh, gone. No warning, no nothing. You know why she pulled me over? I wasn't speeding. I was traveling in the left-hand lane without actively passing someone, which was a lie because I was actively passing someone. I remember it was a gray SUV. That's
holy
all I
crap,
yeah.
Dude.
Yeah. They just pulled me. It was profiling straight up.
That's what I hate, man. That's what I hate.
Yep.
That's the second time I've been searched in my life. And I was accused of stealing a car once.
Oh, my gosh.
But they were like, immediately like, wait, okay, you're not the guy. We thought this truck was stolen. Sorry. Because I was in an old piece of shit truck. Like, I get it. Yeah. It was a Sonoma, you know. It was in Fort Worth, you know. They ambushed me. And then I was like, whoa, what's going on? It's crazy, dude.
That's nuts.
And then they were just like, where are you headed? I'm like, I'm going to Keller. He's like, wait. Okay, take off your beanie. I took off my beanie. He's like, huh. And then he went back to the car and came back up. He's like, so we thought you stole this vehicle. I don't think it's you. Nah. Okay.
Nah, cool. I just...
You're good to go. That was it. It was
That's
like
funny.
But that was like, I was like, wow, that was the easiest time I've had with a cop ever.
Yeah.
That scenario?
It really depends on the individual. Like, I've had cops where they pull me over, and of course, I always roll down all my windows, turn all my lights on, especially at night, just so they can see what's in my car nice, and it puts them at ease, puts me at ease. Everybody's cool, copacetic, you know? Sometimes you just get a real jerk, you know, that just wants to be on a power trip and all that stuff. And it's like, I've been arrested a couple times for contraband in my car, and the cop was nothing but polite to me on one occasion and nothing but a dick to me on the other occasion. You know, it's like, it depends on the circumstance and it depends on the individual officer most of the time. I mean, both of them were highway patrol too. One was the local cop and he was the asshole. Of course, the highway patrol have always been really cool.
Yeah, yeah. State troopers are cool.
State troopers, they see the worst of the worst. They see all sorts of stuff.
They're not worried about, yeah, they're good.
Yeah.
They're cool. They're chill. They usually live in your neighborhood too, so you're like, oh, cool. Like, but the local cops, man, they all think they're Walker, Texas Ranger. Dude.
Oh, yeah, dude.
Every single one of them.
Yep.
You're like, you're not Walker, Texas Ranger, dude. You serve us, you know?
Yeah.
I don't want to say that because they'll immediately get pissed, but.
The least trained and least capable local cops. But, you know, there's been good cops, there's been bad cops. I've had lots of all sorts of different encounters with all sorts of different cops at every different level, and you just got to just treat them with respect until they stop treating you with respect.
Treat them with respect and stand your ground, guys. That's America's message. All right, this has been Toasty. I will have timestamps for you guys. This is amazing.
Yes.
And stay toasty.
And if you see something, say something. Stay toasty.
Thanks for listening or watching if you're on YouTube. You can find us at all the podcast platforms there are in the world. You can also find us on YouTube and follow us there. We are available everywhere. Please share the show if you liked it. The only way we grow is if you share, and that means you care. You can find me at The Real Sky Day on all social media platforms, and you can go see our website at therealskyday.com. See all the stuff we have to offer. We also offer apparel, and that actually does help out the show. TheRealSkyDay.com/shop, of course. But above all else, stay toasty. Toasty.